Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on the program, racism in the Toronto police force.
I am sorry, and I apologize unreservedly.
Chief Raymer, we do not accept your apology.
Does an apology cut it? Excessive use of force on black and visible minorities in Toronto. How damning is the new report about Toronto police, which revealed the force disproportionately targets black, indigenous, and other marginalized communities? What has to change? We will get a response from advocates to the new report. No one from the Toronto police would join us. Then, border blues.
ArriveCan is an important tool.
We're being forgotten. The border cities are being forgotten.
Why are some mayors calling on the government to scrap the ArriveCan government travel app? We've got a Canadian mayor and an American congressman on the other side of the border to make the case. It's time to give the entrance app the exit. Plus, high-flying GG expenses. The governor general is facing questions over a sky-high in-flight catering bill. What's the explanation for the nearly $100,000 tab for a trip with 29 people? The press gallery will dig into the politics of that. All that, plus we'll get the latest on new money laundering report in BC and the massive rate hike in the U.S. and what it means for you. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
As challenging as it is for me as chief and for members of our command and service to come to terms with what our data tells us, I know that it will be even more difficult for those from Toronto's black communities who have been telling us for many years of their experiences. And I want our communities to know I am listening.
Listening, but the question is, what's he doing about it? Look, this is a damning report on police racism, on discrimination. Today, the police apologized, said they were listening, as you just saw the interim chief say, but there was no action plan. There have been countless reports about police racism, about discrimination in Toronto, about carding black and indigenous and visible minorities. But today's report is different only because it comes from the police itself. It's based on their own data. It's based on data previously unseen. So it literally confirms what members of the public have known for a long time from other reports, that yes, systemic racism exists in the force. There's stats on it. It's not an opinion. It's data. It's fact. And that visible minorities are over-targeted. In other words, the threat is coming from inside the precinct. For example, the black population makes up just 10% of the Toronto population, but they experience close to 23% of the arrests, tickets, and use of force. Let me dig deeper into this for you. The black community is 2.2 times more likely to experience an enforcement interaction. That's what the report calls it with the Toronto police. And they are 1.6 times more likely to experience use of force at the hands of police. Black residents were also 2.3 times more likely to have firearms, twice as likely, more than twice as likely, to have firearms pointed at them when not perceived to be in possession of a weapon. If you're a white Torontonian, you are 1.4 times more likely to have less than lethal force applied when they're perceived to be in possession of a weapon, when they're perceived to be in possession of one. Like, it's remarkable. Indigenous citizens are also overrepresented in strip searches by 1.3 times relative to their presence in arrests. We asked the Toronto interim police chief, James Raymer, to join us. He declined, as did his deputy. We also asked the Toronto Police Association president. They declined. We also asked the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police. They were unavailable. We asked Mayor John Tory. He was unavailable. None of these people would appear on this program to discuss the findings of this damning report. So how do we get accountability? Well, let's find out what needs to happen. Moya Teklu is the executive director and general counsel of the Black Legal Action Center and will later be joined by Sandy Hudson, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Moya, let me start with you. First, your reaction to this report.
I'll tell you what I didn't experience, and that was surprise. This information isn't new. The statistical data we've had for decades. The Ontario Human Rights Commission released a report in 2020 and 2019 that demonstrated much of the same information we're seeing today. Studies have been published on anti-Black racism in the criminal justice system and policing as early as the 80s and earlier than that, probably. And so I wasn't surprised. I don't know what my reaction was. I don't know what my feeling was, but it wasn't surprised. It was confirmation, I suppose, right. Maybe disappointment, but definitely not surprise.
Yeah, and Moya, that's what I said at the beginning. This is, everybody knew this. Now this is data that the police are saying, but there's no more dodging it by police. This is a fact. This is what even their own statistics have reflected, what decades-long statistics have said. Were you surprised? How about this? Were you surprised that they get the report and there's an apology, but there's no action plan?
So, no. I think the fact that we've known about this issue for decades and that we continue to experience, and Black people continue to experience, disproportionate rates of arrest, disproportionate rates of charging, disproportionate rates of assaults, of strip searches, is very indicative of what we're going to be seeing in the future as well. And that is that the police are incapable of policing themselves. The police are incapable of reforming themselves. And they've shown that time and time again.
So get at this. The police chief apologizes, says he's listening. They hold this press conference. What needs to happen to make some kind of plausible change in your view?
In my view, for a plausible change to occur, it needs to happen at the federal, provincial, and municipal government at those levels, and not within police services. We saw an example of that with the release of this data. That was a result of the Anti-Racism Act, the Provincial Anti-Racism Act, requiring the collection and dissemination of this data, because for years we were asking for it. And for years, we were told that that they weren't going to release it. And when it was released through freedom of information requests, the validity of the data was questioned. And so what we need is statutory reform. What we need is government action, and specifically a decision to detask the police, and decision to redistribute the resources that are being eaten up by a police service that has shown itself to be incapable of protecting and serving Black people.
Okay, and I want to put some data on that for our viewers, Moya, if you don't mind. The Toronto Police Service, they have a budget of $1.1 billion. The interim police chief, who declined to join us today, has asked for $25 million more. They have a lot of resources. This is not, it's not a resource issue in your view. When you say a redistribution of those, that kind of money, what do you mean?
I mean, we know the federal government themselves have issued a report talking about the social determinants of justice. We know what the factors are that funnel people into the criminal justice system: income, employment, housing, education, health. Access to those services, increasing access to those services, will increase public safety. Redistributing the funds away from police services that can only ever react after a crime has occurred, to actually preventing crimes from occurring and providing people with a better quality of life, that is what needs to happen. And I just, you know, you talked about the $1 billion budget of the Toronto Police Service. For context, the Black Legal Action Centre is mandated with serving all Black people in the province of Ontario, particularly low-income Black people in Ontario. Police complaints make up the bulk of our complaints at the services that we deliver. We have a budget of $1 million. So, you know, just want to put that out there for comparative purposes. So, yeah.
It's remarkable. I just before I let you go, and I'm speaking to the executive director and the general counsel of the Black Legal Action Center, Moya Teklu, whose budget, by the way, first of all, what you're saying surprised me, is $1 million. And we're talking about a police service with one asking for $25 million on top of the $1.1 billion that they already get. But Moya Teklu, do you think, if you are a resident of Toronto, you're Black, you're Indigenous, you're a visible minority, after today, after the police chief apologized, anything will actually change?
No. I can add more, but really, the short answer is no. We've received apologies from the police services in the past, and yet here we are.
As you say, no surprise on this data, but it is now One thing it does do is it ends the doubt about it. There's no way to doubt it. The police have confirmed, but everybody is already all known. Moya Tekler, I really appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, border cities are gearing up for summer travel, but is the federal government's ArriveCan app raining on their parade? Remember, the federal mandates are ending, but what about the ArriveCan app? Well, we've talked to an American congressman and a Canadian mayor on both sides of the border. They say, you know what? Time to end that. Give it the boot. We'll find out why next. Stay with us.
ArriveCan is an important tool that continues to be valuable to protecting the health and safety of Canadians and those who are arriving. Having said that, I know Minister Medicino is working with our caucus colleagues, with our mayors, with stakeholders on figuring out what else can we do to improve the process.
Okay, well, more travel news for the Minister of Transport. Now it's about the ArriveCan app. Is it time for the ArriveCan to be the ExitCan app? That's the message from a group of border mayors. They're backed by a congressman on the U.S. side of the border, Congressman Brian Higgins, who has long called for more relaxed travel measures between Canada and the U.S. Remember, yesterday, the federal government announced that domestic and outbound travelers won't have to show proof of vaccines to enter Canada. Travelers also won't need proof of vaccines to get on a train or a plane. Border mayors argue would-be travelers at the land border are bypassing Canada because of the app. That's actually slowing things down. So it's time to dump it. The mayors are saying it's jeopardizing Canada's tourism industry as a whole. The Tourism Industry Association of Canada says tourism contributes $105 billion to the economy before COVID hit. So the ArriveCan app basically getting in the way of our economic boon of summer tourism. And should it be gone? Let's find out. It's good to welcome the Congressman Brian Higgins, the Democratic congressman representing New York's 26th district, and he co-chairs the Canada-U.S. Interparliamentary Exchange, and the Niagara Falls Mayor, Jim Daudaty. Great to have you here. Mayor, I'm going to start with you. Why does the ArriveCan app need to go?
Well, I appreciate having the opportunity to speak to it. I mean, we all stood shoulder to shoulder in the beginning when the federal government rolled it out. We knew why we had to do it, and it was a good idea at the time. But it's long outlived its usefulness. I mean, we've always said follow the science, and the scientists are telling us this is not serving any purpose. Originally, it was to keep COVID out. Well, it's been here. We've all been vaccinated. We've got our boosters. All it's doing now is choking the borders. In places like Niagara Falls, we depend on tourism. 40,000 people count on tourism to feed their families, and the Americans are not returning. And the number one reason is because of the ArriveCan app. And I've heard so many disaster stories. This is a man-made disaster that we can change. You get a family showing up in their minivan at the border, and they do not have the ArriveCan app uploaded. They don't have Wi-Fi. They don't have access to roaming. They block the lanes in the border. They go to secondary inspection. They're literally going through a harassment. They go home. They tell their friends, and the message spreads, avoid Canada. So we need to get rid of it.
Congressman Higgins, you're supporting this. Is that true? Is the ArriveCan basically thickening the border? Is it really a problem?
It's a big problem. As the mayor said, we have been communicating, the mayor and I and his fellow mayors. They're smart. They're closest to the people. They know what's going on here. And the ArriveCan is redundant. It is suppressing our need to get back to a sense of normalcy as it relates to U.S.-Canadian relations and the economies of Western New York and Southern Ontario. 83% of Canadians are fully vaccinated. 67% of Americans are fully vaccinated. We need to get back to a sense of normalcy. Listen to the mayors. They're closest to the people. They're smart. They've endured over 24 months of hell with all these border restrictions that have been imposed by both the U.S. and Canadian governments.
Mayor Daudaty, did you expect yesterday when the government said, look, by June 20th, we're going to get rid of all the vaccine mandates for planes. Did you think, my gosh, get the ArriveCan app is something that you got to get rid of as well? Were you surprised they didn't? And have you talked to the government about that?
So, yes, I was surprised and disappointed. I mean, it was a half step, certainly in the right direction, but it was a half step. The elephant in the room is this ArriveCan app. It's a disaster. And the fact that our federal government has put $25 million more into it, I do not understand. Nobody can understand the rationale. And I did speak with our federal tourism minister and our federal public safety minister, both of them, about this issue. And I suggested to them, listen, if you guys just seem to love this ArriveCan app, then keep it for the airports and get rid of it for the cross-border, the border crossings at the lands, because here is the majority of where people cross. Here in Niagara, we've got four crossings. It works out to about 10 million cars and trucks per year. And in a regular season, we're always worried about congestion at the border and that turning people away. 50% of the revenue comes from Americans visiting us. So it really matters about that travel and trade across the border. So we said, if you're that in love with it, keep it at the airports, get rid of it at the land border crossings. And they said, you know, that's a reasonable approach, but they made it quite clear the decision has to come from the top.
Yeah, well, the decision came from the top yesterday. They kept it. Congressman Higgins, just one last thing to you. If this is causing a problem, are you hearing from Americans that say, you know what, we'd love to go across the border. Our dollar goes farther there. We have family there. But that ArriveCan app is a screw-up. Have you lobbied the federal government to say get rid of it?
Without question. We've been doing that throughout. The ArriveCan is redundant. It is bureaucratic, and it keeps people from making that cross-border trip that they otherwise would take without having to pre-register. The fact of the matter is a lot of people in Canada and the United States are now fully vaccinated. We need to get back to a sense of normalcy. We've had to make adjustments for more than 2 years. ArriveCan made sense at a time. It doesn't anymore. And I agree with this mayor, and I agree with all the mayors, because we have economic and life quality stake in this. Our economies are deeply integrated, and we all want to get back to a sense of normalcy. And the mayors are, as I mentioned before, closest to the people. They feel it, hear it every single day, and I hear it too from my constituents.
Right. Just before I let you go, I got about 10 seconds. Congressman, can I just ask you, and we'll discuss this later, there's a big rate hike today in the Fed there, you know, another 75 basis points. There's a real concern about inflation. Are you worried about the economic health of your economy there? Because Canadians sure as heck are with those rate hikes.
Obviously. And we have an inflation problem that's very high. The highest in four decades. It has to be dealt with. The Fed has the tools to manage this. I don't want interest rates to increase, but if it gets inflation under control, it's one of the tools that we need, in addition to unclogging the supply chains that exist right now that hurt both the economies of Canada and the United States. As I said, our economies are deeply, deeply integrated. My sense is that these rate hikes will be a short-term measure designed to do one thing, bring down the rate of inflation, bring down the cost of living for people in both the United States and Canada.
All right. Everybody's watching that real close as the Fed hikes by 75 basis points. Congressman Brian Higgins, Niagara Falls Mayor Jim Dowdaty, great to have the two of you on our critical border and our neighborliness. It's good that at least we're talking. Good to have you gents on.
Thanks, Evan.
See you, Mayor.
Some other news you need to know right now. Canadian military police have charged retired Lieutenant General Trevor Cadieu with two counts of sexual assault. Cadieu was charged over incidents alleged to have taken place in 1994 at the Royal Military College in Kingston, Ontario. He was supposed to take over as the commander of the Canadian Army last September, but his appointment was suspended due to the investigation. Cadieu retired in April, traveled to Ukraine on his own to help defend against Russia's invasion. He previously denied any wrongdoing, and he's called the allegations false. Meantime, as Canadians brace for more interest rate hikes this year, as we just spoke about with the congressman, south of the border, the U.S. Federal Reserve has raised its key interest rate by 75 basis points. That is the highest jump in nearly three decades. The U.S. Central Bank is trying to slow the growth of inflation, as Congressman Higgins just told us, as it hits a four-decade high of 8.6% in that country. Policymakers have indicated, here's the crappy news, more hikes are coming. Stocks rose this afternoon following the announcement. They're hoping inflation will go down. Meantime, a prominent figure of the so-called Freedom Convoy, that trucker protest that took over the streets of Ottawa earlier this year, has pled guilty to a charge of counseling to commit mischief. Tyson Billings, nicknamed Freedom George by his fellow protesters, was a central figure in the three-week protest against COVID-19 restrictions and other issues and the federal government. Billings was co-accused with the prominent organizer, Pat King, whose trial is expected to go ahead as planned. He seems like he's got out there, but remember, he pleaded guilty. So I don't know what he's celebrating. Hundreds of millions of dollars of cash laundered through BC's casinos. How does the BC government stop the rampant fraud and money laundering detailed in this explosive new report? We'll dig into the latest next. Stay right here with Power Play.
Sophisticated money launderers have used British Columbia as a clearinghouse or a terminus for laundering an astounding amount of dirty money. Even though we cannot accurately put a dollar figure on the volume of money laundering that takes place, I conclude in my report that it is a vast amount. While much of this activity has occurred covertly in the shadows, some has happened in plain sight.
Stunning report. Hundreds of millions of dollars laundered through BC casinos between 2008 and 2018. That's according to the findings in a new report commissioned by the provincial government. It slams the BC Lottery Corporation and the government ministers responsible for gaming, saying they didn't do enough to stop rampant fraud, although they did not find any government corruption. It's important to know. How does the province deal with this, and what's the fallout? Let's bring in CTV's Shannon Patterson with the details. Shannon, let's just start with the problem. What did the report find about how big this is?
Evan, the scope of this problem between 2008 and 2018, as you said, it was staggering. Hundreds of millions of dollars was laundered through BC casinos during that decade. For example, in the year 2014 alone, $1.2 billion worth of cash transactions, all north of $10,000, were registered. How did this money arrive? It arrived in bricks of $20 bills held together with elastic bands. It arrived late at night at casinos. It was handed to gamblers through the windows of darkened luxury vehicles. These gamblers were told they didn't need to win or lose. They just needed to launder the money. And the only thing that stopped this, or at least slowed it down, was a couple of years ago when the laws were changed here, where any cash transaction over $10,000 in a casino had to be registered. You had to have proof of funds. You had to leave your name and contact information. So the scope of this was staggering. It's something that has been hinted at for a while. And today we finally got a look at just how big it was.
Crazy. I mean, these are out of a movie, just going to the casino and laundering the money. Who was held responsible, and who did the report kind of nail down?
Commissioner Cullen pointed the finger, I think, mostly at the BC Lottery Corporation for essentially allowing this to happen. The commissioner said there is no way that security staff and managers at the casinos didn't see these stacks of cash in duffel bags arriving at their casinos. There's no way they couldn't have known that this was ill-gotten gains, that this money was being laundered through their casinos. There was also some blame cast upon two former ministers responsible for gaming here in BC, specifically Rich Coleman, who back in 2010 was told a little bit about the scope of this problem, and also former Premier Christy Clark as well. They were both told this was a big issue, that it was a big problem. And while they did take some steps to correct it, the commissioner thought they didn't do enough. However, as you pointed out, important to note, there was no finding that any government official or lottery official benefited personally financially for sort of turning the other cheek here. There was no finding of corruption on behalf of the government.
So Shannon, how will the province respond? How do they stop it?
Well, there are 101 recommendations in this 1,800-page report. So there's a lot for the government to go through here. Some of the key recommendations: they want the province to appoint a dedicated anti-money laundering commissioner. They also want to change that threshold for having to report cash transactions at a casino. Right now, it's $10,000, which is better than it was before, which was, there was no limit. The commissioner wants that lowered to $3,000. dollars. He's also recommending a lot more use of civil forfeiture to try to hit the money launderers where it hurts, in the pocketbook. He also wants more oversight of a bunch of different industries here in BC. That includes lawyers, accountants, mortgage brokers, and also some more money laundering training for police.
Yeah, I mean, boy, those casinos have been used essentially for organized crime in such a massive way. This report details it. All right, thanks so much. I really appreciate you joining us. CTV's Shannon Patterson on that massive new report out of BC. Thanks, Shannon.
No problem.
Stay with us. A fight for answers at the committee studying the use of the Emergencies Act this year. One of the members of that committee, NDP Matthew Green, will join us as a special guest on the press gallery. Is the government stonewalling? Why did they not even take notes on high-level meetings? What the heck is going on? And calls for the resignation of Marco Mendicino. We'll dig into all that next. Stay with us.
Do you have notes? Do you have notes?
I'm speaking to you now about the content of those conversations.
I'm asking you if you took notes.
It appears as if you refer to that binder a lot. Would it, in its entirety, can you present it to the committee?
These notes are for my own personal use.
And you don't take notes? As a former police officer of decades, you don't take detailed notes on your meetings?
I've always been very careful in you know, carrying any notes or paper with respect to matters of significant confidence.
That was a wild scene last night. A lot of questions for Chrystia Freeland and Bill Blair, two ministers who were very critical members of the government when they invoked the controversial Emergencies Act, but they didn't give a lot of answers last night at the committee. That was the Emergency Preparedness Minister testified to the Joint Committee alongside Chrystia Freeland, the Deputy Prime Minister, saying, you know, we didn't even take notes on some key briefings as to why we need it, so we can't show you any notes. Look, the committee is studying the first ever use of the Emergencies Act, and they're trying to get some answers. But so far, the government's saying, look, we do not have any notes on it. And what about the minister who's been in the front of this, Marco Mendicino? As we showed you last night, he has repeatedly said the government acted on the advice of police, but the police say we never gave them the advice. And last night, Bill Blair said, you know what? They never even asked for it. It's the government's call. Now Marco Mendicino is facing calls by the opposition to resign. Our special guest on the program today was on the committee last night, and he joins us today on our press gallery alongside reporters Stephanie Levitz with the Toronto Star's Ottawa Bureau and Zian Lum as a reporter with Politico. And again, our special guest is the ethics critic for the NDP, Matthew Green, who we just featured there. Great to have all of you here. Mr. Green, I want to start with you because there's calls for Marco Mendicino to resign because allegedly, according to the opposition, the Conservatives, he's misled Parliament. Do you believe that you, who voted for the Emergencies Act, were misled by Minister Mendicino or others who have said we've acted on the advice of police and police told us to invoke the act and so we did? Do you believe that you've been misled or Parliament's been misled?
No, I mean, at this point, they're splitting hairs. It feels like a diversion from what I think is the Conservative Party's culpability in this, but it should be noted that the minister, and in fact all ministers who've been present at committee, have refused to be forthcoming with very basic information, and that is a significant and serious cause for alarm.
Okay, but do you feel then that the NDP were led down the path? Like, here you are, you voted for the Emergencies Act, you thought it met the threshold, and have you got any evidence from Minister Mendicino, Minister Blair, Minister Freeland? Have they given you any transparent information that you can confidently tell Canadians, yes, they met the threshold to invoke the Emergencies Act?
I mean, we confirmed the Emergencies Act after it was invoked, having witnessed and experienced, quite frankly, what thousands of people in Ottawa had experienced and based on information that was made publicly available. I will say, though, that no, this government has not, I think, adequately pleaded its case to the Canadian public, regardless of what side of the issue you're on, with just the basic information. We had a finance minister who couldn't quote any specific economic impacts when even the city of Ottawa came forward with some numbers. It's quite concerning, quite frankly, given the seriousness of this, the historic nature of it, the special composition of the committee, that time and time again, witness after witness, they just refused to provide even basic information.
Let me bring you Stephanie Levitt. So now we've got, and we showed this last night in the program, we showed it again, Marco Mendicino on multiple occasions, February 21st and then on in May, saying they acted on the advice of the police, and no police chief, RCMP, the Ottawa police have saying we never asked it. Then Bill Blair said, you know, actually nobody asked for it. So what do you make of the calls for the resignation, and if is this a misunderstanding or a misleading?
Has to be fundamentally, where's the accountability and where does that buck stop? I mean, if the New Democrats, with apologies here to Mr. Green, if the New Democrats are going to prop up the Liberal government ongoing while at the same time argue that no, the government has not met the threshold for invoking this historic piece of legislation, then do you pull down the government over it? I mean, at what point did Canadians rise up and say, hey, the government lied to us? And when it came to this historic, again, historic use of this legislation, ought not there be some accountability for this if the government cannot convincingly make the case that it needed to use it? It's a matter of precedence what they've done. And so if the Liberals can't justify it through facts, data, science, whatever they'd like to use to justify it, then what's to stop another government from doing it this, you know, for some other reason? I think it's a very serious matter of parliamentary accountability that the Liberals put all of their cards on the table here and explain to Canadians specifically why they needed this piece of legislation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jean, what is your view of this? You know, Minister Mendicino explicitly had said they're acting on the advice of police. Police said, we didn't give them advice. And now we're hearing, well, they just wanted powers. They're not supposed to invoke it, so we do that job. Is this misleading or misunderstanding, quote, splitting hairs, as Mr. Green says?
Well, I think the proof is in the pudding, but just the problem is we haven't seen the pudding yet. And the committee tried to find pieces of it yesterday. But I want to, you know, pick up on the accountability piece that Steph kind of picked up on and kind of return to that clip that you started the segment with. You know, I skipped dinner time to watch this committee. And, you know, in retrospect, I should have eaten my dinner because the deputy prime minister didn't tell me anything new, per se. It was basically a masterclass in self-preservation. Freeland was unwilling to supply finance documents when asked by MP Green and others on the committee. And everything she said was largely a pastiche of what has been already said in previous statements and references to, you know, materials already on the public record. I get the reflex that, you know, maybe you don't want to make news, but, you know, it's a choice to provide testimony to add value to an investigative process versus coming off as, you know, making a mockery of it or a potential mockery of it. In the second block, you had the clip of Bill Blair. It was his, turn in the hot seat, and he was candid and kind of, you know, forthcoming in some of the answers that were that he provided to the committee. But it was also very incredible to witness the public safety minister's confidence and non-apologetic tone when he said, yeah, I don't take notes. That was a really revealing moment. There's an entire culture and whole workflows on the Hill that are designed to kind of minimize paper trails. And that pre-existed the invocation of the Emergency Act, and that pre-existed the pandemic too. So my takeaway from the committee was that, you know, cabinet's paper trail allergy continues to influence present day operations, including exceptional circumstances where decision makers are mulling the invocation of unprecedented emergency measures. And, you know, that was both incredible and disappointing to witness because those are reflexive of systemic and intentional exercises that undermine accountability.
So, Mr. Green, just do you believe this? We don't have any notes. Is this going to undermine credibility, which would raise the question that you don't believe them, but does it raise the question, how are you going to get a credibility, accountability from a government that you support?
Well, listen, the confidence and supply agreement is something else. What we're talking about right now is the Emergency Act Review Committee. I think anybody who's watching it knows that I'm doing a good job holding this government to account. We have unlimited parliamentary powers to send for documents, people, and evidence. That is established in jurisprudence. We have legal opinion to that fact. We will be using every single tool that we have available to ensure that this government provides with candor and clarity the information that our committee was constructed to
But you don't believe them. I just want to be clear. When you say there's no notes, are you saying that they're
no.
lying, that
I
they actually have
it.
Notes, or that the
it.
Staff?
No, it's unbelievable,
okay, so
Evan. It's unbelievable. And when I hear the minister say he himself personally didn't take notes, that's fine. But I can't believe that in that room they didn't have senior staffers taking notes. And so what we need to do is get a hold of the notes. Clearly, the ministers who were present had a binder full of notes. So let's start there. Let's get to the information and let's find out exactly what they knew, when they knew it, and what they did about it.
Steph, I mean, look, Parliament's going to rise, and I don't know, this week, next week, I don't know, but how big a political problem is this now? You've got Mr. Mendicino, and the Conservatives calling for his resignation for misleading. How serious is this right now politically, and how does it cut politically?
Well, I mean, you know, to pick up on, again, a point that Mr. Green raised before about the Conservatives sort of using this as a political cover for their original support of the convoy, right? And some of them really speaking up in favor of the messaging coming from the Freedom Convoy, dismissing the anti-government sentiment, the anti-establishment sentiment that was there as nothing more than a few bad apples. You know, this is easy for them to just, sometimes in politics, it's a pretty cheap call to say so-and-so must resign. Right. It's pretty easy and it grabs a lot of headlines. Can the Conservatives continue to politically weaponize this throughout the summer? I mean, they're heading into, you know, the crunch of their leadership race. And that's going to occupy certainly the Conservative rank and file. We also, of course, have the the more broader public inquiry into all of this, or the public commission that is going to spool up its work. So it's not like the story's going away, even though the Commons is going to break for the summer. And again, I mean, it becomes a question, I think, in the minds of many Canadians. There's those of us who live in Ottawa, witness this firsthand, and, you know, may have had a visceral response to what was happening, calls for action, wanting something to be done. That's one piece of it. But the second piece of it, again, is the government choosing to invoke for the first time these historic and unprecedented measures to seize people's bank accounts, to, you know, make tow truck drivers move in, do all of these things. And it has to be considered more broadly than that. Was it an overreach of government power? And I hope that Canadians are thoughtful about that question, even if they sort of dismiss the idea, oh, it was just a bunch of protests in Ottawa that needed to get cleared.
Okay, I got to leave it there for our special guest, Mr. Green. First of all, I really appreciate Matthew Green joining us as our special guest on the panel. The press gallery is going to stick around. Steph Levitz and Zian, of course, are coming up next as we talk about the Governor General. Now, the trip to Dubai racked up nearly $100,000 catering bill on flights to Dubai. What's the perspective on that? How much is too much? Is that excessive? What happened there? Is it fair to put this on the hot seat? We'll dig into the politics of big pricing coming up next on the Press Gallery. Stay with us. Welcome back. Is this the old $16 glass of orange juice that cost Conservative Minister Bev Oda her job? Well, this is a different. This is a week-long trip for the Governor General, nearly $100,000 spent on in-flight catering. That's right. A trip that the Governor General Mary Simon and an entourage of 29 people racked up heading to and from Dubai back in March. We know these figures because they were requested from Conservative Michael Barrett, who was on this program tonight. Rito Hall said they have no part in the meal selections. That detail and those decisions are up to the Department of National Defense. CTV News did reach out to the department for a response, but they have yet to get back to us. Now, remember, these kind of expense scandals are nothing new, nor are they tied to one party or a governor general. Governors generals in the past have faced these issues. The prime minister faced a backlash for the $8.6 million renovation cost to his lakeside residence at Harrington Lake. Remember that. Interim conservative leader Candace Bergen under fire for moving costs into Stornoway, which cost nearly $20,000. And there was bed and linens there for $5,200. She was on the hot seat. So is the cost of the catering bill for the governor general too excessive? Or is this the cost of doing business internationally? The press gallery is going to discuss this. Stephanie Levitz, reporter for the Toronto Star, is back, and so is Zian Lum, reporter with Politico, and our own CTV national news reporter, Andy Bergeron Oliver, is here. Steph, I'm going to start with you. Like, we need comparison numbers, but when you do the, when you crunch the numbers on this, $100,000 flying back and forth to Dubai, 29 people, it's like $3,000 a person for catering plus. That's a lot. What do you make of it?
You know, these stories are so funny, Evan, right? Because they're a bit of a Rorschach test about how people feel about
government
spending.
I don't think we can hear you, Steph. Hang in there. Try again. Can we get Steph's audio back? Steph, can we hear you?
Am I here? Can you hear me now, as the expression goes?
Okay. Hang on. We're going to get back to Steph. I'm going to start with you, Annie. Go ahead.
You know, it does on the surface seem like a lot of money, $93,000. And as you point out, $3,000 per person. I think to the average individual, that does seem high. And it is when you look at some of the other trips that the governor general has taken, or you compare them to some from the prime minister, for example. If you looked at that order paper, you know, a similar trip for the prime minister with his staff as well as other people was around $57,000. There was another trip as well that was around $46,000. So I think the question is, well, why is this one so much higher? I think what is important to point out here is that there are a lot of questions that we don't have answered. For example, you know, why was it so high and what is the breakdown? If you look at the order paper question as well, it says that it's not just catering costs in the sense of food, but it's catering costs, it's non-alcoholic beverages, it's international waste management, it's landing fees, security costs, airport fees, talks about the cost to keep food cold. So there is a lot there. But again, when you look at sort of the other flights that were on the order paper, you look at some from the prime minister, it does appear high. And I think why people are really kind of attached to this or talking about it is because it really does provide insight into sort of a trip that a lot of people don't know much about and only see in photos. And there are a lot of people who question whether it's worth these types of trips, worth the expense, especially when you look at the fuel costs, which were over $200,000.
Yeah, no one could do anything about the fuel costs. By the way, Steph, I apologize. It was the screw up on it was on my end. I couldn't hear you, but I think the audience could hear you. So I'm going to go back to Steph
great.
And then Zian. Steph.
Yeah, so what I started to say before was these stories are a bit of a Rorschach test, right? I mean, there's people who look at them, and really the stories are pretending, here are the facts, here are the numbers. Do you think that's too high? Do you think it's efficient? We in Canada love to nickel and dime our politicians over everything. And sometimes, yeah, a $16 glass of orange juice can lead to the resignation of a cabinet minister. But those types of stories are usually, you know, one tiny detail about a broader sense of entitlement or behavior that leads to the resignation. The governor general is our head of state. And so when people look at these bills and they think to themselves, oh God, that seems high. Well, what would seem appropriate to you? I mean, if the idea is that she's there on representing Canada on official business. And I think Annie makes a great point, though, about the nature of these trips. And we hear a lot about the value of public diplomacy, how important it is for people to get out, meet each other, make the case. But we don't necessarily see the benefit of that. What does it bring to Canada in return? What was the bang for our 100 grand here, you know, for the buck? And how do the decisions get made about what gets served and how much gets costed out? And why does it matter in the end? What are we concerned about as a nation? That the bill was too high, not high enough, that there's no delivery for the trip? Or is it just, you know, a big number and sort of eyebrow popping at the time everybody knows their costs are going up and are wondering if they can afford even their groceries, never mind a pretty expensive jaunt around the world?
Yeah, Zian, your sense of this. Look, we understand, by the way, that when these planes fly, as Annie and others have talked about earlier, you know, they got to replenish their food in Dubai. So it's expensive, right? They got to get the catering. I have no idea and we haven't had a breakdown of what the cost to cater it, but be pretty darn expensive. It costs $3,000 to get whatever the heck you're eating there. But what do you make of this and how Canadians ought to respond to this kind of thing?
Yeah, I get the value, you know, protecting the public purse, that angle to the story. But I also understand, you know, the argument that this is the Queen's representative in Canada. Do we really expect the Governor General to fulfill their vice regal role and to be on the good side of the monarch by, you know, feeding guests a steady, you know, stream of, I don't know, grilled cheese or something. You know, credit to the Governor General's office for being transparent with the expenses when they're asked, you know, but looking at the bigger picture, you know, I'm not sure who benefits from this kind of conversation over this set of specific costs. Like you said, I also haven't seen an itemized list of what was purchased and for how much during this trip. I don't want to diminish, of course, the merits of scrutinizing how governor generals, both present and past, use public money. But this ultimately reminds me of a conversation that I had with Northwest Territories Premier Carolyn Cochrane yesterday. She told me that there are people in the territory who pay, you know, $800 to $1,000 just to fly to Yellowknife to buy their fresh produce. And sometimes they have to pay, you know, $30 per liter of milk. So, you know, where's the attention for those food costs paid by regular people, you know? Why isn't there a greater political attention or a higher partisan value ascribed to advocacy for those high bills paid by people as well?
Yeah, I just Annie, real quick, I got a second here, but, you know, I've known Mary Simon just as a public figure for many years, and it's not like she's a person of great access, and we just don't have the breakdown. She doesn't fit her persona to be riding high like that, but you just wonder, where is the why does it cost this much, and what's the politics of that?
Yeah, I think that that's what people are asking. Why is this one higher? Why did it cost $93,000? And as you pointed out, is it because the food was more expensive in Dubai or because there were other fees, landing fees, these types of things? I think it really just comes down to transparency and people wanting answers now that these numbers are out here. You know, the Governor General's office, as Rideau Hall, had no say in any of this, that it was DND, but the Canadian Armed Forces is not providing any answers. We've been pushing them all day. They say they're working on it. We gave them a deadline. They didn't respond. And so people are questioning that. You know, we spoke to the Taxpayers Federation earlier today, and they're saying this also provides, you know, not very much money, and they want to know, like, how much does it cost on the ground for other types of expenses that are not being shared right now?
Well, okay, I got to leave it there, but maybe one reason why we have these conversations is why 24 Sussex for whoever becomes a prime minister is basically a ruin, because the politics of paying for something never happens, and now we don't have any place for whoever is the future prime minister to live. Steph, Zian, and Annie, great to have the three of you on the program. That is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks for watching. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones. That is the great privilege. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great evening.